ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
What does it take for an innocent woman to wish she'd been charged with murder? 3 years in a Chinese prison.
At times, I even wished that I was a normal criminal, a garden variety criminal, because then I could speak freely to my lawyer. Then my family could visit me. If I had committed murder, my situation would have been easier than that sort of opaque, absolute isolation and mental torture.
Journalist and mother of two, Cheng Lei, was working for a state-run Chinese TV station when she was arrested in 2020, accused of breaking a government embargo by just a few minutes.
And to say that arbitrary detention only affects a few people would be utterly wrong. It is like an earthquake that reverberates to this day, that shakes everything to the core. Our trust, you know, our belief in the liberal order. People ask me how I am, and I find it very hard to say, fine, thank you. I'm not fine. I am sometimes euphoric. I'm sometimes very, very sad. I am sleeping too little and trying to do too much because there is a huge crater that I'm trying to fill.
We saw the headlines, Australian in foreign prison, China, Iran, Myanmar. Well, today on Big Ideas with me, Natasha Mitchell, you'll hear their stories firsthand together and why they think their experiences can help other Australians and their families who face this horrifying situation. They formed a new group, the Australian Wrongful and Arbitrary Detention Alliance, or AWADA. So joining Cheng Lei is economist Dr. Sean Turnell, who spent 650 days as a prisoner of Myanmar's ruling military junta, accused of mishandling state information after working as a special advisor to ousted Democratic leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Scholar of Middle Eastern politics, Dr. Kylie Moore-Gilbert, who was arrested in Iran while attending a conference, accused of espionage and locked up for 804 days in two of that country's most notorious jails. We're joining them at the launch of AWADA at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute in Canberra, hosted by its executive director, Justin Bassey.
Arbitrary detention and hostage diplomacy are among the most ruthless practices that countries use to coerce others. Troublingly, they are also increasingly common. The very idea of turning individuals, innocent individuals, into bargaining chips to gain the upper hand in strategic differences and international disputes shows a lack of respect for human rights and a lack of regard for international rules that defines authoritarianism. It puts the detainees' own nation in a treacherous position in which they must do everything they can to secure their citizens' release while avoiding encouraging more hostage-taking in the future. That is a very complex challenge. Sometimes, quiet diplomacy to behind the scenes is the best approach. At other times, governments need to speak out clearly and firmly, maximising attention on the case. The right approach is not always clear, nor is it always clear when the moment arrives for a change in approach. And whether it is China, Iran, Myanmar, or terrorist groups, each regime or criminal group's reason for detaining our citizens is bespoke. One principle on which Australia has been firm has been never to pay financial ransoms. To do so puts a target on Australians because it's a clear, unequivocal case of rewarding the hostage takers, whether they are governments or non-state groups. Finding other, smarter and more strategic ways to identify levers to pressure the detaining government and negotiate a release is a fraught and complex business. Doing so without rewarding the hostage taking and encouraging more of it is harder still. Meanwhile, the detainee suffers at the hands of the foreign jailers, families get understandably distressed, and the public gets frustrated. As with most complex issues, it comes down to a mix of approaches. Giving clear advice to Australians travelling to countries where arbitrary detention is a risk. Understanding the pressure points of the detaining government. Some deft diplomacy and painstaking negotiation. As we move further into a period in which authoritarian governments are growing in their confidence in flaunting international rules and norms, it's clear we need better approaches. better policies, better strategies, better support for those detained and their families. That's why ASPI is very proud to be hosting the official launch of the Australian Wrongful and Arbitrary Detention Alliance. Three of the founding partners of this alliance, here with us today, carry enormous authority on this issue, each having been arbitrarily detained. We congratulate them on their bravery, their resilience, and their determination to help others who go through the same brutal treatment they have. And unfortunately, there have been others, such as Ken Elliott, who was held for 7 years by Al-Qaeda terrorists before being freed last year after years of painstaking work from government and agencies. There remain Australians arbitrarily detained, such as Dr. Yung Hen Jung, who has been detained since January of 2019. And regrettably, there will likely be more in future years, which is why learning from past experiences, deterring the practice, and improving how we respond to it is so important. And why it's my great pleasure to introduce Carly Moore Gilbert, Chung Lei, and Sean Turnell. It's an honour to have you here to talk about hostage diplomacy and the critical work that your new initiative will be doing. We do seem to be, as we've talked about, seeing a rise of the use of arbitrary detention. And unfortunately, when you see such a rise of a particular type of malicious activity, it generally means that those who are carrying it out, the aggressors, sense that it's working. So is that what is happening here, do you think, that it's we're seeing more hostage diplomacy, more arbitrary detention, because it is actually working for those who are carrying it out?
I think there's no doubt that it's working. I haven't really seen much done in the space of disincentivization because it's such a thorny issue. I mean, how on earth do you prevent or see off this practice before it happens? It's also very difficult to quantify and measure, of course, and, you know, how do we quantify something that hasn't happened? So I'm sure there are cases that could have potentially happened that we have prevented, but, you know, we're not aware of them necessarily. It's part of this broader narrative of the breakdown of the international rules-based order and the growing strength of some of these more malign authoritarian actors and almost sort of copycat approaches, particularly when it comes to wrongful detention and hostage diplomacy, you know, between China, Russia, Iran, Venezuela, North Korea, you know, the usual suspects. Because it's paid off and been so successful for some of those countries, I think we've seen others amp up their use of the practice too.
Because democracies can't fight back using the same tactics, because we care about our citizens.
Absolutely, right? You know, it's not a level playing field. We can't resort to what they do. We can't just take an innocent Chinese person hostage because Chung Lei was in prison and say, hey, then let's make a barter exchange for these two. We have the rule of law, so we have to stand by those principles.
Therefore, free media.
Yes, absolutely.
It's excellent. It's exactly the dilemma, which is why your group, What AWADA Will Do, will be able to canvass both the individual issues, the specific issues, but also where there may be asymmetric responses of not a tit-for-tat reciprocal, you detain one person, we detain the other, but where there may be other levers that can be pulled. Detention, kidnapping, hostage diplomacy has impacts at multiple levels, at the individual level, national level, international level. I'm keen to get to all three. Could I ask all of you, each of you has your own experience of detention and state hostage taking, and each of the perpetrator regimes, Iran, China, Myanmar, were all motivated by their own unique circumstances. So to each of you, I'm sure you get asked a lot. I'm sure it's something you've thought about long and hard. But why do you think you were detained and why the particular regime that detained you did so? Sean, we'll start with you.
Yeah. So I think mine was basically to get at Aung San Suu Kyi, the civilian leader of Myanmar. And I think by targeting me, it was about building a case against her, but a particular case against her, because in many ways the military that rule Myanmar now are profoundly xenophobic and anti-Western. And so that's a particular badge then of being too Western and controlled by the West that they want to hang on Suu Kyi. So by arresting me, did two things. They could build a fake case that I was sort of her handler and she was my agent and so on. But also, just applying to that greater narrative, though, that she was beholden to the West and I was sort of an obvious example of it. I think there were some circumstantial aspects to it as well, which I was there. There weren't many foreigners there. This was in COVID. It was a sort of peak COVID and there was no getting out of the country and so on. So the fact that I was sort of, you know, all plumped up and ready to be got, plus that incentive of, you know, sending a signal to Suu Kyi, I think that was part of it. And then I think in a broader sense, in terms of the conversation we're having here, also about sending a signal to the West and to foreigners, don't interfere. If you do, this is what will happen to you.
Yeah. So it's the disincentive to others.
Yeah,
definitely each case is not just bespoke to itself, it's relevant. Kylie?
Yeah, I think in contrast to what Sean just described, mine was rather opportunistic. I don't think it was necessarily a premeditated thing. I mean, my captors, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, are more of a kind of a mafia gang or a thuggish sort of militia group rather than a sophisticated entity per se. And I think they pick people up and then they shake them down for information and determine your price in the shakedown process or the interrogation process, and later on figure out what to do with you, essentially. What concessions can they demand in exchange for you? So, you know, it's people often ask me, did they lure you to Iran or in some sort of grand scheme or plot or something? And I really don't think so. I think it was just wrong place, wrong time, bad luck. And then I was made into a hostage essentially after my arrest rather than prior to it.
Yeah, it's that the differences between each of the regimes and even how they then responded with experience being in offices at the time, foreign ministers' offices, there's a lot more engagement. Even if you don't get anywhere engagement with the Iranian regime, there were with other regimes, including the military regime or lay with China. Lay, what about you?
Well, there is someone in town who can answer this question definitively, but he's not doing press today. Of course, that is a question I get asked and a question I ask myself repeatedly, and it's still something that I'm working through. Of course, at the outset, I was told, this is not hostage diplomacy. But when you think about the timing of the surveillance, of the arrest, the details that they knew, what they asked for, let's just say there are many, many questions that are unanswered. And China has been at pains in the past to say, for example, in the Huawei CFO Meng Wanzhou case, that the arrest of the two Michaels, the two Canadians, was not related. And you will do so again with other Australians detained in China. So that's what's so awful about arbitrary and wrongful detention. At times, I even wished that I was a normal criminal, a garden variety criminal, because then I could speak freely to my lawyer. Then my family could visit me. If I had committed murder, my situation would have been easier than that sort of opaque, absolute isolation and mental torture. And to say that arbitrary detention only affects a few people would be utterly wrong. It is like an earthquake that reverberates to this day, that shakes everything to the core. Our trust, you know, our belief in the liberal order. People ask me how I am, and I never say, including Senator Daniels, and I find it very hard to say, fine, thank you. I'm not fine. I am sometimes euphoric. I'm sometimes very, very sad. I am sleeping too little and trying to do too much because there is a huge crater that I'm trying to fill. I look at my mum. It wrenches my guts out that she's gone to Kylie's house with me for lunch and held her baby and now doesn't remember, even when I show her the photos. It kills me because I see how she must have suffered. There's a look on my son's face when I say, oh, I'm too tired to go bike riding with you, or he has to wait a little bit longer to do fun things with me. It's not just that moment's disappointment. It's more than 3 years of waiting for mum to come home. My daughter hides it all beneath teenage bravado. But I notice this hysterical edge to her sardonic humour. She's had to be adamantly independent as defence against missing mum. Broaden it out to my circle of colleagues and friends who have crossed China off their list for travel, for study, for business. Broaden out even further, policymakers having to rethink their approach to dealing with China in all sorts of fields. The overseas Chinese community split over the direction that China is going into and Aussie-China relations. So it's not just about, oh, well, she got locked up a few years, she's come back, we should all be happy. And of course I am so happy because, you know what, today's Wednesday, and if I was still back there, without all of your help, without all of our government's help, I would still be there, having just eaten the Wednesday menu of boiled onions, which you have to eat for fibre, but it stinks the whole place out, and then squatting on the toilet floor, washing my plastic bowl with my hands and a bit of soap. And thank God I'm here. So that's thanks to all of you. But I guess I'm just making the case for why we should care about arbitrary detention. And I'm sorry I've hogged the microphone.
It's very important. It's devastating to hear what we can't possibly understand as much as we might want to. But why you all deserve so much credit and your fellow founders is because you are putting yourself through, obviously remembering what must be some horrible memories, but you are doing so to try and help prevent more people being detained or put us in a better position for when it does happen. So as absolutely hard and as difficult as it must be, it is incredible that you are all putting yourself in that position to constantly relive it to help others. And those others, of course, include, as you say, family members who feel helpless through the situation. How, if you're willing to talk about it, how has your arbitrary detention, the hostage diplomacy that you've all gone through, how has that changed your lives but also impacted your families? What we don't tend to see, as you say, when we simply get the euphoria of someone being released. Sean?
I'd say, like, at a big sort of political level, it's enhanced my belief in things like democracy and the rule of law and so on, which are no longer abstract norms but absolute lived reality. Incredibly elevated my faith, funnily enough, in human nature, both for incredible reaction. Just to echo Lay's point about, you know, the response of the Australian community is just phenomenal and, you know, just so heartening and all of that. But even amongst prison guards, my police, some of them, and fellow prisoners and so on. So my faith in humanity is actually sort of elevated than before. And just to, if I could riff a little bit on that, Justin, just to reflect upon the whole issue of hostage diplomacy more broadly. And I think it does work for regimes in terms of their own narrow purposes. And it is copied by other authoritarian regimes, again, for their own narrow purposes. But I often wonder whether it actually does work or not. And where I'm going on this is that my Myanmar prisoner colleagues would often say to me, Sean, you'll be okay. You come from a powerful country. And what they meant, they didn't know anything about Australia's defence force or even economy or anything like that too much. But what they meant was about a society that was coherent, that would come in support for me and would be constantly agitating to get me home and so on. And in a sense, it was a spectacular example of soft power. Because, of course, the people in Myanmar, I mean, no way would they rely on their government that way. In fact, the very opposite, of course. Their government was the source of oppression. So it is interesting, I think, both in that sort of knowledge of what I think is a not too perceived soft power countries like Australia has, but, yeah, those broader virtues, which I think, for me, are just greatly enhanced and need to be defended, but they are are also, as I say, a real source of strength, I think.
Did your family feel the same way, though, that they come away with yes, rule of law, or it was it all took too long?
Yeah, I think so, but I think this is something we all share as well. Families suffer uniquely, I think, compared to us. In fact, in some ways, they get it worse. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I think we physically suffer more, but I'm not sure that they don't psychologically suffer more, because we know what's going on to us. We know the situation.
We can't tell them what's going on.
Yeah. And,
I imagine the
yeah, yes. And then when we get back, we do things like this. But they're at home and they're having to confront incredible difficulties, you know, at every stage in the process. But all the practical stuff, the stuff that, you know, we don't celebrate as being heroic or whatever, but it's just hard slog and great anxiety.
You feel the same way, Carly?
Yeah, I'd echo everything that both these Sean and Leigh have already said. I mean, the family, as Sean said, it's harder on them in many ways, and they imagine the worst, and you might not have communication with them for lengthy spells of time, and when you do, you can't speak freely. You know, how much information they
There's
have
so
from
much
other
mis-
sources
is misunderstanding, right?
Yeah.
Because the timing, by the time you've written a letter, I still get a big kick out of the fact that I can text my partner, Nick, even though he's in PNG, and he really wanted to be here today because he's also a co-founder and he's worked so hard to fight for my release, that I can text him, and even if it's just an emoji, and I can get a reaction, whereas in detention, I would write, and I didn't even get to write to him until 2 years later. But the fact that, you know, my letter would reach him 3 months later and he's like answer to my question would then reach me after that. It's horrible.
Turning to the national level, if I can, in my mind, there are a couple of elements which need to be focused on at that level. How to deter the hostage taking to begin with, and second, how to respond in a way that simultaneously prioritises the person who has been detained but doesn't then immediately incentivise more of it. So, both in the context of your own specific cases, but also more generally, are there things that could be done better in this space at the national level? What did you learn worked and what may not work? And as an example of that, I'd be keen to hear your views on quiet versus public diplomacy. Carly, could I start with you?
Gosh, there's so many questions in that to unpack. You know, a lot obviously works because the three of us are here sitting talking to you today. And if it didn't work, as Leigh said, we'd still be in our cell perusing the menu of that day's prison fare and twiddling our thumbs and wondering if anyone's remembered that we're there. So, you know, all credit to the excellent people working within DFAT, working across various government agencies and in the respective embassies that did bring us home and pulled off, you know, in my case at least, what was a rather, you know, impressive and dramatic diplomatic feat in order to get me out of there. I think having the flexibility to think outside the box and think with creativity about solutions in the diplomatic space is really crucial. Our adversaries are thinking creatively. You know, when they pick people up and the kinds of demands that they might be making in exchange for them, often it's all opaque, it's all behind the scenes. It's not always a clear-cut transaction. It might be more in that fuzzy, you know, intangible space, whatever changes hands, you know, that is offered in exchange for somebody. So they're thinking creatively and they're operating as such. We need to be like that too. And elevate this out of whatever bureaucracy it might be mired in and act quickly and expeditiously as well. This is a comment that I often hear from speaking to a number of people who've gone through this abroad and in Australia that, oh, there was this window of opportunity right at the beginning before everything became formalised and set in stone, before I was put on trial, before I was in the justice system. Maybe if someone had have thought creatively and quickly and acted, you know, fast to get me out, that would have eventuated and I wouldn't have gone through these years of ordeal. So I think thinking in that space and, you know, having somebody who is responsible for doing that legwork and coming up with strategy from the get-go, I think is crucial in that.
And just to add to that, Kylie's point about, you know, our adversaries are thinking and we need to too. And the good thing is that some of that thinking is taking place. And so in Australia, we needn't reinvent the wheel on this stuff. So there's been some really good initiatives, or look good, they're in the very early days, from Canada and the USA, which is all about changing that incentive changing that calculation, as well as, I think, expanding the instruments that are available. So one of the things the Canadians do, for instance, have a quite separate and sort of walled-off set of sanctions that apply to hostage takers, which can separate that out, say, from broader political considerations. You know, you can imagine the extra scope a foreign minister could have, say, negotiating with Myanmar or China or Iran and say, well, look, OK, these sanctions are available to me to impose for this. I may have other measures that I need to take with you, whether with respect to trade or defence policy or whatever it is. Maybe there's another event going on, like a coup in the case of Myanmar, and you want to respond with sanctions that way or whatever it is. But you keep, in a sense, the issues separate, which gives you another whole set of armaments, if you like, to meet this particular crisis. But it just seems to me that, yeah, there's some good thinking going on at the moment about disincentivising and just giving, I think, broader weapons, if you like, to people in democracies to respond more flexibly and, yeah, just a broader range of instruments.
I want to come to Chang Lei on the issue of what may have worked well and quiet diplomacy versus when to go public. But it seems though you raised sanctions. If I can just maybe ask, really keen to know if you have a complete alignment or any nuances there in relation to asymmetric options like sanctions. We seem to, in Australia, like many other liberal democracies, be reticent to impose sanctions when a country has detained an Australian. In my view, if there is either a blanket rule that says we're not going to do something like that, or even if it's not a rule, but there is a perception that Australia won't sanction, either for the particular specific case or for separate human rights abuses, that's a problem. From the regime's perspective, that'll actually show hostage-taking in this way works. Would you have supported, in each of your cases, the Australian government imposing sanctions, including Magnitsky sanctions, on the military regime, on Iran, on, say, those responsible for human rights abuses in Xinjiang, or on your specific cases while you were detained, or would you have been against such imposition?
I'd have been strongly in favour in the case of Myanmar, which, again, is an interesting example because there would be other reasons why we wanted to sanction or take action because of grotesque human rights abuses and all that sort of thing. But keeping them separate, again, is a way of just sort of adding arrows in the quiver, if you like, as how to respond.
Yeah.
And it does sort of just change that calculus, I think.
Carly?
Yeah, I mean, I was in prison during a period of mass protest in 2019, a kind of a precursor to the Mahsa Amini movement that we saw erupt in Iran a year and a half ago. And I saw protesters hauled in and we heard that it was a nationwide thing. And so people were talking, OK, is the West going to sanction anybody? Are there going to be any implications for these gross human rights violations that we are seeing in front of us in the prison happening? And, of course, Evin prison is sort of the hub of political prisoners and where they're taken in Iran to be tortured. So we were at the coalface of that, and I actually expected more would be done in that space, not necessarily by Australia. I think, you know, we're a middle power. We're not going to be out leading the charge against Iran in terms of its human rights record, but I was surprised there wasn't more sanctions and more activity on that basis during that uprising, and certainly following the Mahsa Amini killing and the subsequent protest movement in Iran as well from 2022 onwards. So I think the Iranians themselves were probably surprised that there wasn't more of a response and probably prepared for one for that eventuality themselves. I was quite gung-ho when I was in prison and was all for sanctions against anyone and everything, including my own captors specifically. And had there been a Magnitsky regime in place at the time, I would have been very much in favour of the individuals explicitly involved in my unlawful arrest and incarceration and psychological torture to be singled out and symbolically sanctioned, recognising that they do not have any assets likely in Australia or any actual, you know, meaningful action we could have taken. Often these people exist in the shadows. You know, we're not talking about sanctioning the foreign minister of Iran or somebody who's well known, although maybe we should sanction him too, actually. But, you know, Magnitsky sanctions are targeted at a specific individual. That person has to be a repeat perpetrator, not someone who's done a one-off thing. And we know, especially when it comes to Iran, that hostage diplomacy is a business model, and they've become very proficient at it. They almost invented it, we could say, with the 79 embassy siege of the US embassy after the revolution. So these guys are repeat perpetrators. We know a lot of their names, but they're not published in the world media. I'm sure intelligence would know them, but you know, the broader public doesn't. So the act of singling them out and sanctioning them and saying, this is why we're sanctioning you, we know what you're up to. You're taking innocent Australians hostage and leveraging them for concessions, and that's not okay with us. I would have been very much in favour of that, even if it had a negative implication on the ability to get me out in the end.
Yeah, I think there's a strength in bringing a face and a name to what's going on rather than just the regime. Leigh, what about you?
I think the answer to that question differs from country to country. Obviously, Australia's biggest trading partner is China, and it's a much bigger country. The level of repression is different. Protesters, what are protesters in China? They don't exist. And coming back to your other question about whether quiet diplomacy works, I think in my case, the bigger disincentive for China was the negative press that my detention had generated in Australia. And to that, I'm very grateful to all of my media peers here and to Nick, of course, who kept the story, you know, at the forefront of people's minds, and to our government for appealing to China for compassion to bring mum home to her two kids. That's why each detention case is different and the solution needs to be bespoke. So like Kylie said, you really need to be creative, whether it's the media strategy or the government negotiations.
Thank you. If I can move to the international side, Sean, you already mentioned Canadian processes, and for a little while leading into 2021, Canada itself, obviously having gone through the two Michaels case, to their credit, they established the declaration against arbitrary detention. I think smartly at the time, it was country agnostic. It was simply wanting as many states as possible to show that there is a norm against the practice. But it's not just the two Michaels. It's the UK has gone through it, the US, Sweden, many countries, so many victims. What role do you see that can be played beyond individual countries when our citizens are detained? How important is international partnerships in this area, and what can we do to build on that Canadian-led declaration against arbitrary detention?
So I think the first thing on that is just to acknowledge that it takes place anyway. So incredible cooperation amongst the usual suspects. And certainly in my case, you know, I had very much the US Embassy in my corner, the UK, New Zealand, Canada. It was the traditional lot. So just to say that happens and was immensely important for me. So I guess for that, just to go on. But then the other thing, as you mentioned, Justin, about the Canadian story, also the American story with that special presidential envoy for hostage affairs. And so it's, yeah, very much an American, more razzmatazz version, I think, of the Canadian one. But we can learn from each other and grab what we need and then use it, as Leigh said, in a bespoke way according to the individual situations. But, yeah, I think there are strong lessons each of us can learn and share and so on.
Do you see how important the 60-odd countries that joined Canada in 2021? Now, 2024, we need to not just rely on pointing back to a generic statement. Do you think we need to move on to something with teeth now?
Absolutely. This is a symbolic declaration. There's no commitment in any practical sense by these countries who've signed on to it. It's great that it exists, and it's more, I guess, a recognition that this is a problem and a growing problem faced by like-minded countries throughout the democratic Western world. That's all great, but it's not doing anything about the problem. And it's not even... the Canadians have been pushing, and the US behind them, for a multilateral approach to this issue. But we haven't really seen this coalition form that has actually done much to tackle the problem. It's still each state alone, going on its own, as Sean said, reinventing the wheel each time. Yes, they cooperate sometimes, but there are many cases where they don't necessarily communicate or cooperate with each other as well as they could either. And there's no real mechanism for them to sort of get together and, you know, even the Five Eyes, for example, and necessarily collaborate in a formalised way on this issue. So I think much, much more can be done in this space. Also in terms of international law, it's a bit of a protection gap issue. You know, we have a hostage-taking convention, I think it's 1978 or 9, doesn't really mention state actors. People kind of fall between the cracks there unless it's a non-state group that's taking somebody hostage. So international legal mechanisms can also be updated. I would really love to see this develop into something with teeth, but I think the Canadians are full of enthusiasm. I've spoken to a few of them, and the US is kind of going it alone also, but doing a lot of great things. But I just don't see other countries, Australia included, necessarily stepping up and matching their commitment just yet.
Lady, do you think you mentioned the differences when it comes to China compared to other countries where you might not have the economic relationship? Do you think that that collective action would actually be a way to ensure that even a major power like China that knows that it has some extra powers over, dominance over many individual countries, that we need to work collectively, and that could be a way to impose some cost on China?
Of course, there's safety in numbers. And in the same way that China uses investments to win over smaller countries, you know, the ideals of Western democracy can do the same. And in my case, Nick did get a lot of useful advice from the former Canadian ambassador to China, who was actually brought in for that role for 2 years to secure the release of the two Michaels and other Canadians. So that was very, very useful, because the problem with China is you don't even know if you're speaking to the right people a lot of the time, and you don't even understand the internal structures. Mm-hmm. So when you have, you know, the knowledge of someone who's been through that to know who to go to, that's very powerful.
The US has the Levinson Act. Canada has, I think it's a bill at least, if not an act. Do you think that's a next step for Australia? We should be looking at those key partners and following?
Yeah.
Nods, yes.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's as AWADA, as this newly formed alliance, that's one of our objectives, is to push forward the conversation on some act of legislation in this space.
OK, I'm sure there are a number of questions in the audience. If you're happy to raise your hand, and as an ASPE team member who will provide a microphone, if you can say who you are as you ask the question, that'd be great.
First, I want to say thank you to all three of you for speaking tonight. I can imagine the immense courage you would have taken to talk about the situations in which you're all in, and voicing your concerns for such a pressing issue in the international community. I was really interested in what you were talking, Carly, about earlier, Australia not really wanting to go down the line of sort of like sanctions and everything in their sort of space. First, I'm just wondering why that is. Is it because Australia doesn't have sort of the capabilities to impose strict and harsh sanctions? Is it because of their concern of only being a middle power? They don't have much weight in the international sort of community to really pull something off like that? And I think just as like a wider question as well is, why hasn't there been much done about it in the past? I think because I can imagine that situations like this would have been occurring for the last 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years almost. So why is it now becoming such an important issue now, and why governments haven't acted on it in previous years?
I think whilst hostage diplomacy, hostage takings existed for time immemorial, it's definitely not a new phenomenon. I think the linkages that we're seeing between malign authoritarian actors are growing stronger in this area than had been in the past, and our power as a sort of a Western bloc internationally, globally, is vis-a-vis such actors is lessening. So their space to manoeuvre and the kinds of concessions they might be able to get have perhaps changed compared to, you know, in the Cold War era or the era of the two big superpowers. You know, in terms of sanctions, Australia, I think, I mean, I'm not going to put myself in the position of the people who make these decisions. I'm sure they have a myriad different considerations at play when dealing with the bilateral relationship with whatever country we're talking about sanctioning. And I think rather than seeing it as a broader phenomenon, this hostage diplomacy phenomenon that's, you know, happening again and again and involving repeat perpetrators, often governments have a tendency to view each case in isolation as an individual case. And, okay, we're tasked with getting this person out. When that person comes out, job done, case closed, you know, let's move on to the next diplomatic challenge. And it's not necessarily viewed holistically in terms of a broader phenomenon. So joining the dots there and positioning hostage diplomacy as an issue that's bigger than one or two cases, I think is really important, and that might lead governments to then look at disincentivization mechanisms like sanctions, whereas in the past they might not have thought that was necessary.
Hi, my name's Christy. I work for Defence, but I'm here today in a private capacity. Just reflecting on the point that every country and every hostage is different and the solution has to be bespoke, I have a question for Lei. What's your best guess on why they let you go but held on to Yang Hengjun?
How do I answer that? I think each case is different, and I'm sure DFAT has done all it can in both of our cases for the best outcomes. It's a very, very difficult question to answer. And in fact, the freedom guilt that we all suffer is tremendous. When I heard about his sentence, I couldn't stand still. It's almost like we question why we're here and then they're not. And in our meeting with Minister Wong this afternoon, we thanked her for raising the case with the Chinese foreign minister. And she assured us that they will continue to do all they can for Dr. Yang. And I'm sorry, I don't have an answer.
There's definitely no need for you to apologise. It is a complex issue. I think what it shows is what talked about at the beginning, that the toll these issues
take. The arbitrariness is the most cruel part.
And separates authoritarian regimes from liberal democracies.
With law and order. Yeah. If we were two murderers, you know, and we got different sentences, then the media could write about it and we could protest. But none of that's going to happen because it's so hidden and secret.
Hi, Eamon Gumley from Defence. I'm interested in focusing on your point about media coverage during the time of that you have kind of taken hostage. And my question kind of regards, how do you balance the, like, an optimal media approach whilst dealing with kind of the different natures of the regimes that have taken you hostage, hostage safety, and then kind of the biggest point, I think, which is the length of captivity. You know, media works pretty fast and it's hard to keep that pace over the long term.
So I think that the media aspect, there's two aspects to that. One is the media impact on the taking country, the hostage taker, and the other one is on home. The home one's sort of fairly obvious because I think the media puts pressure on our own government, which, you know, has the best will and all the rest of it, but I think the media keep the focus, et cetera, as well, and families can use that to keep our own governments up to the mark sort of thing. The second aspect then is the impact on the hostage-taking country, and this gets back to the point that I mentioned earlier, that I'm not sure actually if we pull right back that hostage-taking actually does work for those countries, because those countries exposed to the light of what they're doing, I mean, it's pretty bad, right? I mean, China's international respect seems to me to have plummeted in recent years, not coincidentally related to its increasing hostage-taking. Likewise, in a country like Myanmar, the whole charges, the whole thing was so absurd that as soon as it was exposed to the light, everyone could see the absurdity and the regime ends up looking incredibly foolish and without credibility and so on. So to me, the media does both of those aspects. You know, it can really shine on the poor behaviour of the hostage taker, but then it has that sort of very fundamental function, I think, domestically as well, which is to support families, in their case, to the home government.
I'd add to it that there are ways to do media smartly and there are ways in which media could potentially undermine whatever efforts the government is attempting behind the scenes to undertake to secure that person's release. And, you know, I think in Lei's case, Nick ran an exemplary campaign in that he didn't, you know, attack the Chinese government vocally in public or anything like that, and very much kept the focus on the personal story that you're a mother of two children, those children are growing up without their mother, you know, this is a good person, this is somebody who, you know, wouldn't hurt a fly ordinarily, and keeping the focus on you and also the pressure on our government to do something rather than necessarily attacking the state that's undertaken this act. Although the attack is, it's not an attack, but there is an implicit understanding there that a wrong has been done to an innocent person. And, you know, I can think of examples of cases in which the media has not been managed in a smart way, and potentially that may have hamstrung efforts by government behind the scenes. So this is why having a blanket ban on any media coverage whatsoever is not a wise step. We should be assisting families in engaging in a constructive manner with the media as part of a broader strategy, if it is deemed to be useful, rather than sort of pressuring them, you know, and many, many countries have this line. I'm not talking about Australia here, sort of taking an automatic knee-jerk approach to just saying, don't do any media whatsoever. If we use it wisely, it can be really productive and assist, but the converse is also correct, and so we have to be careful. And recognise that it's a tool and part of the broader arsenal rather than something to be necessarily afraid of, I think.
Yeah, flexibility is definitely key, because when Nick first found out, his first reaction in those couple of weeks was, if we can still keep this from the media, from getting out, there is still a chance that I would be released. It would be done all on the quiet and China wouldn't lose face as such. But after that, he saw, you know, that wasn't going to happen. And once we go to media, then what is the best strategy? And in fact, my family, my dad specifically, had a very different view. For example, last July, when I was at wit's end, I wanted to shout how much I missed this country across the oceans. And it's not easy to never know when the embassy visits are going to happen. So you just rehearse in your head what you want to say. So I had been going through all of the things I loved about Australia, about being Australian. And then my dad, through the lawyer who came to see me after the embassy visit, said, your dad thinks this shouldn't go public. So he was of that blanket ban on, perhaps because he had suffered persecution at the hands of the Communist Party, that he just thought it's not a good idea. But to me, I felt so awful. It was my only chance to speak for a person who doesn't have a voice, and my own father doesn't want to respect that.
Your agency's taken away from you, and that's the only kernel of agency you've been able to rake together in months and months. And
and I had waited 3 years to say this thing, and I'm so glad Nick gets me, and Nick respected my wishes. And I don't think that it was damaging, as my dad had feared. In fact, it might have had the opposite effect. So, and that, again, speaks to how wonderful a people we are.
It had a huge impact, your open letter, I think.
I think there's also another aspect, which is protecting the hostage, right? So the more international publicity there is, the more, most of the time, the Navalny case, I guess, is contrary, but most of the time it gives a degree of protection. And I know that this is a real dilemma, again, you know, since being released, that I faced with respect to Myanmar colleagues still there, and how much do I publicise their case? And in a couple of cases, I've actually taken the deliberate decision to publicise them, put their photographs in my book, do that sort of stuff, with the fear that it may draw attention to them, but at the same time that attention is probably better for them on balance. But it's a difficult calculation. But that whole way in which the media potentially puts a little bit of a protective layer around the hostage, I think is something as well.
I mean, there's going to be blowback. So after that letter went out and there was a lot of press, and presumably China, the detention centre, got a bit of flack, the letters and books were withheld from me for a month and under the guise of something else. But as long as I think the detainee is aware of the blowbacks and wants to accept it, like in your case with your hunger strikes. I think it's always, almost always best to respect the wishes of the detainee.
Hi there. My name is Max, and this is a bit more of a personal question, so please don't feel obliged to answer if you feel uncomfortable. But what was your source of courage during your time in detention? And it's a real question for the whole panel. Thank you.
At the risk of both repeating myself and you know, sounding a little bit too perhaps sunny, et cetera, but it really is the strength that you get, that you feel the support coming from Australia, in my case, mediated through my wife, my family and so on. I mean, that above all was everything. You know, understanding that was far and away the most important thing. And then I guess there's those other issues in our circumstances, the courage and compassion of the people we're imprisoned with. The Indigenous people of the home countries suffer much worse than certainly I did. And so taking their example and so on. And then in the practical things, I mean, all three of us, we're obsessed about books. Books just come through again and again and again as the thing. We were talking about the pain upon leaving the books that have become your friends. The title of the author, the cover, the physicality of the book, et cetera. So that was a really practical level. That was critical as well.
I drew a lot of strength from my fellow prisoners, and they're what got me through, really. And I pay tribute to the remarkable women of Iran. I think, you know, I'm blessed and privileged to have known some of these people from very close quarters, and I carry that with me and probably will forever, and I see them as my sisters. And, you know, I drew a lot of strength from them, as well as important knowledge and information about my predicament and how to conduct myself within it as well.
Final word, Jolay.
Humour, gallows humour, which we still trade. My cellmates, they had less than the foreigners did. So helping them, sharing my books, knowledge, teaching them, 80s pop songs.
Yes. Cool.
Because it's such a desolate place. Anything that is pleasurable and reminds you of beauty and why we live, that keeps you going.
Three absolutely remarkable people, once quietly living distinct and separate lives, but now with the most unexpected, nightmarish ordeal in common, being arbitrarily detained in foreign countries. You heard from journalist Chung Lei, who ended the conversation, and she was joined by economist Sean Turnell and academic Kylie Moore-Gilbert. And now they are, as you heard, harnessing the horror they went through to counter the growing threat of hostage diplomacy. Thanks to their new group, the Australian Wrongful and Arbitrary Detention Alliance, or AWADA, and the Australian Strategic Policy Institute for that event here on Big Ideas. And that's where we say goodbye for now. My name is Natasha Mitchell. You can find Big Ideas, 4 new shows a week, over on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. And I look forward to your company next time. We're bringing you live events with big thinkers from all over the world.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.